Justice isn't about fixing the past. It's about fixing the future. We're not fighting for the dead. We're fighting for the living and for those who aren't yet born.
Welcome to the Busy Girls Book Club. We are bringing you all of the internet's most popular books and telling you whether or not you should take time out of your busy schedule to give them a read. I'm Caitlin.
I'm Catherine.
And I'm Casey, and today we are reviewing the third book in the Red Rising series called Morning Star. It's the third book in the series, so you guys should know what's up by now if you're listening to this episode. But this book, also disclaimer that the earlier parts of the episode are going to be spoilers still, because we're not going to spoil this book, but we will spoil the other two books. Morningstar picks up where Golden Sun kind of leaves off. So I'm trying to even think back to the very beginning of where
Pharaoh is captured.
Yeah.
Pharaoh is captured and he's being tortured by the Jackal. And where the book starts off, we're not sure basically what's going to happen. We know that he has to escape somehow, but we don't know what's going on. And there's like a year, I think, total has passed since the end of Golden Sun. So at the very start of the book, we're also not sure what has happened with the resistance in the time that Darrow's been captured.
But so, Ares is dead and Roke's a traitor.
Yeah.
Yes. But Golden Sun leaves off on this huge cliffhanger where Roke betrays Darrow, and then all of Darrow's most powerful allies basically are killed, and his secret is also outed. So also Gold Society, or the upper levels of Gold Society, know that he's a Red. So they also are now dealing with his secret, at least being semi out in the open. But again, we're not sure at this point who all knows Darrow is a Red. So yeah, obviously shit happens. Darrow does escape. I don't think that's too grand of a spoiler. And then after that, they basically have to go to war. So this book is very battle heavy, and they are trying to, you know, fight the Sovereign and win the war and unleash all the enslaved colors.
Good summary.
Kind of.
You can't say much at this point.
No. Like, yeah. Every, like, 20 pages, there's a new spoiler. Like,
yes. There are a lot of twists.
Yeah. Because the beginning starts off where you know nothing, saying anything is kind of a spoiler, because you figure out slowly. But
we meet a lot of new and interesting characters that we haven't had a chance of meeting before.
Oh, yeah. New worlds.
The universe expands a ton in this book.
But all your old favorites, no one's safe.
Yeah.
Nobody's safe.
It's war. Everyone dies.
Yeah.
Well, do you guys have some reviews from the internet?
So many.
I just have one, and it's not even that funny, but it's also like the tale of events that this person is telling from reading this book is fucking hilarious. So I decided to read just the first part of it. It's a 1-star review on Goodreads, and it says, "It has taken me a million years to finish this book. LOL, had to take it out from the library several times. Lost my driver's license and credit card as a bookmark in this book because I put it down for so long. I couldn't find them and had to replace them. LO Mayo. It was just so long, and I was so not engaged enough to be there for it. I mean, yeah, I enjoyed the series so far. I've enjoyed the characters, but it just got so repetitive and boring."
Okay, well, I don't trust a review by someone who uses their driver's license or credit card as a bookmark.
I know. It was like, that is so reckless.
Genuinely a crazy thing to do.
I don't trust you.
Yes, so. But I just found that so funny that she had to replace them and then found them later.
Yeah, that's crazy. I mean, you're trying to, like, how are you? You have your book with you every single time you get in the car? That's wild.
Yeah, I can't say I've ever used important documents as bookmarks in books.
I'm actually the opposite. I'm toxic in the sense that I often just don't use anything to mark my page.
Do you dog ear them?
No.
You just remember what page you're on?
In general, yeah.
That's crazy.
Psychopath behavior. I could never.
I read too many books.
I've been trying to use bookmarks more now. And I read enough digitally that it often doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah, for sure.
Anyway, I have a 5-star to read. Actually, I have 2 5-stars. They're similar. One says, "This book, I cried, I laughed, I clutched at my chest in actual physical pain from grief and whooped from joy at parts. If you want an emotional roller coaster and want to cheer characters on the way you never have before, pick up this book. I promise you won't be disappointed." Oh, that was cute. But that's I cute. Liked the theme because there was another one like it. 5 stars. "Do I directly invoice Mr. Brown for the medical bills I incurred after receiving treatment for the heart attacks the plot twist in this book gave me?"
That's funny.
Real. Okay, I have a whole handful, and they go up from 2 stars to 4 stars. So I'll read them in ascending order. The first one basically speaks for itself. It says 2.5 Severo stars.
Oh,
I was going to originally give this 1.5 stars, but then Severo came in.
Yes.
And I was like, fair. This one is 3 stars. "Love a straight white male author who puts his female characters in charge and makes his male characters physically and emotionally insane."
Yeah. I told you it was coming back around in the third book that the girls would get more power.
You are correct.
Okay. 3.5 stars. "I finally started enjoying Darrow as a character."
Yep.
Yep.
For sure. Redemption arc, as you redemption would say. Redemption arc.
Growth.
And growth.
We love a good character growth, especially for men.
Yeah, when it was so needed.
We need to lock men in boxes.
That is apparently what taught him empathy.
Yeah.
He said, "Oh, there are things worse than death. Good to know."
Solitary confinement.
Okay, 4 stars. "Pierce, baby, you need to stop flirting with me by writing books this good. My boyfriend is getting jealous."
As he should.
Yep. All right, that's all of them.
I liked them.
I liked them too.
Well, the overall Goodreads rating, 4.54 out of 5 stars. Fable users say 4.61 out of 5 stars. And Storygraph says 4.48 out of 5 stars. So, very well-loved book, very well-loved trilogy. What are your ratings?
I gave it 4 stars. I actually grew to love Darrow in this book. I grew, or maybe not love. Love's a very strong word. But I grew to respect him, and I appreciated the amount of growth he went through in just, like, the first 50 pages. He showed more humility than I ever thought he could. Maybe because he was humiliated. But anyway, and I also liked that he recognized the female characters a lot more in this book and gave them a lot more deference and gave them a lot more respect because they were definitely holding this thing afloat. And also there was like this, this isn't really a spoiler, but the fact that like one of the pinks that joined Harper to bomb and then try and enslave Mickey, he actually feels bad and saying like, she's trying to repent for her sins. And he was like, we all do what we do to like survive. And he's actually recognizing that probably the pinks endured a lot worse than he did because they are sex slaves. And I appreciated that a lot because that was my main critique of Golden Sun, was that he was definitely dogging hard on the pinks who became terrorists. I'm like, well, you reap what you sow. So I felt like he actually understood that pendulum swings go back and forth. And if you reap a lot of violence will come up at you. So, but there were some issues at the end that I didn't love, and I'll leave that at that.
Oh, whatever. Okay. I also gave it 4 stars. I loved this book. You know, I don't think anything will meet the like thrill I got reading the first book in the series. But this book I still thought was very good. I liked a lot of the character developments. I was very upset about one specific character's storyline. So that kind of like lost me like a little point. And then I thought it was kind of slow for a little bit. Like not uninteresting, just like slower paced. And then the last little bit, like everything happened and like the ending was achieved very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was like epilogue, rainbows and sunshine. And I was like, whoa, whoa, where did that come from? So that's why I'm more of a 4-star. It's just I felt a little unsatisfied by the ending. Not that I wasn't like happy about it, but just that it felt rushed.
Yeah.
I would have actually read more of this book. And yeah.
Yeah. Well, I agree with those points. I also gave it a 4-star.
All in agreement.
I know. And this is, I actually think I gave Golden Sun 4 stars too, but this is going to be a much more positive 4-star from me. I agree with what Catherine said. I feel like this author, I don't know, maybe took some feedback and like responded to basically everything I took issue with in Golden Sun, specifically about the treatment of women. Darrow does.
It's called a story arc, baby.
Yeah. Well, it was rough. I just felt the way the women were written in Golden Sun was so condescending. They were given a lot more respect in this book. And they really rise to meet the moment. I think this book had the best variety of characters, like men and women who were powerful and good and bad in different ways. They all felt very real to me. Like you guys said, to me, this book actually felt a little too idyllic at some points. I think one of the reasons that I gave book one so many props is that the twists and sabotage that Darrow dealt with were actually like genuinely unexpected. And I think this book, things felt a little too anticipated, a little too expected in ways that stretched my believability and made for like a little bit of a less like tense, action-packed narrative. But I did overall really enjoy it. I actually think this book has the best pacing out of all of them. I like blew through it. There are some like slower lulls, but I like ate this book up and it flowed really easily. So I really enjoyed it. And now I don't have to be angry at this series anymore, which I'm relieved about.
Yeah. Ends on a good note.
Like also, I guess 4 more books.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
but this trilogy is over.
The trilogy is complete.
Yeah. This book started out, this series started out as a trilogy. There are now more books, and I checked because now I'm interested in reading the other ones. But the next book starts 10 years after the end of this one.
Which makes sense.
It has a bunch of new characters. My friend Brad was reading it, and he said it kind of gives you perspectives of people on each of the planets post. I don't know, liberation from the core. Right.
I heard there were 5 different narrators for each one.
Yeah.
And it's getting a lot more into the actual like political building, because obviously it's really complicated to unite a solar system as opposed to even one planet, much less one country. Also, there's, I think, a graphic novel series now that are prequels that tell the story of the founding of the Sons of Ares and Sevro's dad. So, all interesting stuff. But the trilogy's over now.
Will I have time for the rest? That's the question.
Oh, dude,
great question.
There's a lot of them now.
Yes. Like,
now
I know. And people still want more.
I went into Barnes & Noble and there was a whole table of different books. And I was like, oh, I don't know about this one.
Yeah.
Well, and they're much longer. These were like an appropriate length, and all the rest of them are huge.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, this is book 3 in a series. So this is always a fun question. Was it more plot or character driven?
I think all war books are ultimately plot. However, I do think what made this book good is Darrow's character development. Like, he becomes such a different person after his experience with torture. And for me, that's kind of what made the book, because he could be such a frustrating, arrogant person that really did lack kind of full empathy and understanding of others. And I think he comes a long way in this book. But I do think it's still ultimately plot driven, because they're like fighting a war and it's all about how, you know, are they going to win the war?
Yeah, there's a multi-front war against multiple different enemies that don't necessarily align with each other. So yeah, it's more plot driven, but yes, I agree. Darrow has a lot of character growth in this novel, as well as the characters around him. And he does have a lot more autonomy than he's had in previous books, because he's now the leader of a war front. So yeah, but it's a war book. So obviously there are plots that are above him that he's realizing.
I agree with all that was said. Easy enough. What about, we're kind of already talking about this, would you read other books by the author? Would you read more in this world? Would you read something else he wrote?
I feel like I would be more tempted to read something else than continue with this series. Not that I wouldn't want to continue with this series. It's just that's a lot of time to devote to a series that has many other books now in it that are very, very long. I would be curious to see a new world built by Pierce Brown because he is very good at world building. And I'm kind of curious to see where his imagination goes from there.
Yeah.
I definitely agree with that. I have really enjoyed this series, and I think that Pierce Brown is a really great writer. So I feel similarly. It's not that I don't want to continue on the series, because I do. It's just that it is a commitment, and all the books are really intense. And almost at this point, I feel kind of ready to start over. Like, for me, a trilogy is the perfect number of books in a series, and it's, even if I really like the series, it's difficult for me to want to read past a trilogy. Because it just starts to feel like more and more effort every time because the plots get more complicated. There's all these characters to remember. But I actually don't think that Pierce Brown has written anything outside of this universe, which kind of makes sense because I'm sure he put so much effort into creating this that he doesn't want to start over. But mm-hmm. I would be more intrigued to read something created from scratch.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd be interested. It would depend what it was. And how many girls are in the book.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, this is a cash cow for him. So I'm sure it's hard to refuse some of that money that's coming towards him.
Right. And he's friends with like Brandon Sanderson stuff. He's going to keep writing in his world. So.
Right.
It is what it is.
Now that the girls have come to the Red Rising, you know, now that women are making up, I think, a larger portion of the fan base than they ever have. I would be interested to see if that impacts any future projects because, I mean, it's just sort of obvious that Red Rising started out as like a male fantasy.
Yes.
Yeah. The girls got a hold of it.
Yeah.
The girlies read more than the men. Just saying.
Just saying.
Okay. Girls are just like, I feel like more willing to dive into random worlds just to escape. So.
Yeah. And we will spend our disposable income on it.
Yeah.
We'll cut a lot. God forbid women have hobbies. Okay.
Yeah.
And those hobbies are reading about people killing each other. Get over it.
Yeah.
We watch true crime documentaries for fun.
We should like tally how many people have died in every book we've ever read.
Oh, Lord, that would take forever.
I'm kidding. I don't even want to know the answer to that question.
That's morbid. Okay. How about the pacing of the book? How long did it take you to read?
I agree with Casey that this book was paced the best out of all three of them. But it did take me about a few days to listen to it on audiobook because I did not want to purchase the official copy. And I had a credit remaining at Audible. And I had some free time to just listen while at work. So it took me a little bit just because it is a 21-hour audiobook. But I listened to it on 2x speed, baby.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Yeah, I mean, I stand by what I said earlier. I think this book is best paced and flows the easiest out of all of his books. And so I really blew through this one. I think it technically took me a week to read, but I mostly read it yesterday. I like read like 90% of it yesterday and then finished off my remaining 10% today. So I just knew I wanted to binge it. And so I just waited until I could.
I don't super remember how long this took me. I read it over a month ago, not long after we did Golden Sun, because I wanted to know what happened. And I was sort of, I know I was reading it like on my phone digitally while I was also reading things like Catabasis. So it was like in the middle of a lot of things, but it was a relief between some of those. Like you said, the pacing was fine. Even the parts that felt slower were not uninteresting. They were just like slower parts of the plot, but still had the momentum to keep going. So I thought it was really well paced. And I was always eager to pick it back up because it was something new happening.
Yeah. All right. Would you watch a movie or TV show of the franchise?
Yeah. I'd be very curious to see how it could get done cinematically. It's a very complex thing to handle space wars, but I think it could be the next Star Wars if they really, really invested in it.
Right. Yeah, I'd love to watch this. Google says the rights may have been purchased, but it's been in work, quote, for years. So I don't know if someone actually gets around to it now that the girls are involved. I'm in. I'd watch this.
Yeah. There's one thing about the girls. We'll watch a movie.
Can you imagine the like transformation scene from the first book of Darrow becoming red to gold?
I tried to picture this while I was reading.
Like, yeah. Often, and like, how do you do that to an actor?
You would just have to almost do different actors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, I don't know, it made me think of like PETA in the third Hunger Games movies when he's like emaciated and stuff. I'm like, ugh.
Or Captain America.
Yeah, Captain America was another one I thought of, which they use the same actors.
CGI, yeah.
But this is so different. I'm not even sure you would use the same actor.
I don't think you could.
So. Well, I would be very excited to see this brought to the screen. I am very interested in how it would turn out.
Well, like, they better do it. You've definitely got people who are into the space movies. There's an audience.
Oh, yeah.
J.J. Abrams.
And I think
Star Wars people would love this shit.
Yeah, I feel like it's been a while since there's been like a really good space odyssey movie, like not just like Interstellar, but like a space galactic adventure movie.
Like a saga of things.
Yeah, space wars.
Like Star Wars, like Star Trek. And so I think it's time. I think it's ripe for a Red Rising movie.
Yeah.
Okay. That brings us to our Busy Girl rating. What would you guys give it?
I'm going to stick with my 4. I don't see any reason why not to keep it at 4. Like, it was well-paced. It just took a while. I mean, if you're already this far into the series, you're going to finish it because Golden Sun cliffhanger is going to leave you wanting more, which is perfectly planned by Pierce Brown. Shout out to that. Yeah. And the audiobook was nice and easy to listen to. The narrator is okay. I wouldn't give him all the props in the world just because I don't think his voices are too different. So I sometimes couldn't tell who was saying what. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah, I'm going to keep my 4.
I will agree with you on that. Yeah, I have no issue picking up, putting it down. I didn't want to put it down. It's quick. You're used to the writing style. You're used to the world. Even though it gets bigger, it's not ununderstandable. That was a weird way to say that. Sorry. But so, yeah, I had no issues. I won't say a perfect 5-star just because, like, you have to get through 2 other books to get here.
And it's still almost takes, 600 like, pages.
Yeah, it's still a long book and takes some, like, brain power. But I have no complaints about that stuff personally.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. So sorry to be boring, guys. We're not going to fight.
Wow. I don't think, have we ever agreed on both quality and star ratings?
Rarely, if so.
Probably Chanel Miller was the last time.
Probably.
Oh, I think my sister, the serial killer.
That's true. I think we all were the same on that one, too. Anyway, I agree with those reasons. I think it was a really good read. It was a fast read compared to the page count, but it's obviously still a long book and a long series.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, that brings us to our spoiler alert section. A lot of things happen in this book. If you're listening to this episode, I'm assuming you've read the other 2 books. So I'm also assuming you're not going to spoil it for yourself because you know what a wild ride these books can be. But regardless, we are about to spoil it. So decide if you want that. Our first question up is, what did you think of the Jackal's torture of Darrow and Victra? Darrow was like locked in a sensory deprivation box.
It
was
turned out to be a table.
Yes. Very interesting to read this after reading Alchemized. Not Catherine laughing.
Yeah, I didn't do that, so I didn't think about that.
What did you think of the character growth that Darrow had because of his failure and because of his experience being tortured for like a year?
I think it realigned his priorities, because once you're like stripped down to the core of yourself, you have to judge like what's necessary, what's important in your life. And I think he realizes like how much he's fucked up to get to this point, and how not trusting the people that you think you can count on and not telling them the truth really hurt you in the end. Obviously, Roke went against him, so like that was never gonna happen his way. But not trusting Mustang, not trusting Victra, he kind of trusted Servo, but Servo found out on his own. So it was just kind of like, it was, he reaped what he sowed, and he learned from it, and he learned that like he can trust the Sons of Ares, he can trust the people that he surrounded himself with a lot more. And he also learned that he can't play the game that the Golds set about. He has to come into this, instead of learning how to play the Golds game, he's got to play it like a Red, because they don't know how to deal with a Red. They don't know how to deal with his mind. And so he was a lot more judicious in his killings. He was a lot more, he was an executor, but also a builder, like Mustang wanted him to be. So I think he was easier to read because he was a lot less cocky and a lot less like my way or the highway. I'm the smartest person in the room. He realized I'm not the smartest person in the room. I've got to lean on others to help me out here. And when we all come together, we are a giant brainchild that can actually fix this shit.
Yeah, I think he was humbled. He started to act too much like a Gold, and but was still as trusting as a Red. And he got reality checked. I can't believe he survived a year in that box. And how sick and twisted when you realize he was under the conference table the whole time. Ew.
Crazy.
Yeah. And like the Victra torture too. Like, I don't, it shows that there are also good Golds. Victra was one of them. At first, her priorities may have been self-serving, but then she just kind of, she bought in. Mm-hmm. And seeing how the other Golds treat her, you realize that, like, there's still that divide. And so, I don't know. I like the character growth from both of them and how they were both then almost too reluctant to trust. And it was a growth back to that point. But, mm-hmm. yeah, it was, I don't know, it was fun. And, like, Darrow realized that, like, he may be important, but he's not the most important person in the room. And the only people who were really affected by what he was doing deeply was his family. So he had a lot more like emphasis on like making sure his family were okay. Once he came out of the box, he kind of forgot about them there for a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do think the torture brought him back to himself, because he does really lose himself in Gold society and does start to see himself as this almost like godlike figure. And he even realizes it at certain points in the other books that it just becomes so easy for him to really forget what it was really like to be a Red once you're a Gold, because you have to leave all that behind and survive in the moment. And I think the torture did help him just reconnect with his real self and not this sort of like grandiose version of himself that he created. I do think it also helped him understand the real stakes. Like, this isn't even just about life and death. It's about enslavement, which is a much deeper and more enduring torture than just survival. And he became more empathetic because I think it did. Captivity made him realize that, I think beforehand, he could only really see and value the torture and enslavement that he experienced, because that is what his reality was. And it was much, you know, darker and dirtier and more impoverished than like what the Pinks experienced. I think this helped him realize that just because Pinks are like clean and living in these penthouses doesn't mean they're not also being tortured. So I think overall, like, I mean, I hate to justify the torture, but it made him a better person.
Needed to happen.
Right. And I liked that his personality improved. And also, I think it made the conflict a little bit more interesting, because now going forward, he has to learn how to be a hero again. And I think that was also a really interesting character arc to read, of like, it's sort of like being a red, becoming a gold, becoming a red again, and then what do I become next? Like, how do I stop ping-ponging between these two extremes and like become what I need to be?
He has to evolve. He has to also, like, be the first of the evolution.
He went into the box essentially a child. Like, he was still so young. So once you're in this book, finally, he's like mid-20s. Yeah. You're like, okay,
I
start to give you, yeah. But at least like your frontal cortex is mostly developed now. You know, like,
yeah,
he is making adult decisions now and also standing up to his friends when they're doing things he doesn't believe in. And yeah, he's just a better person. I hate that locking a person in a box makes them better, but.
Yeah. I mean, you can either break or you can rebuild. Well, actually, I think you just break and then you have to reconnect the shattered pieces into something else. Like, that's what he had to do. And he did it in the best way instead of in the worst way, which I think was kind of showed by Victra, because she was really just there for revenge. That was her whole mode of transport. Like, that was her whole character journey until the end, when she like finally lets go. I loved that he saved her when that wasn't the mission that Holiday and her brother were there for. But he was like, no, we're going to save her. She was my only true friend. And I betrayed her by not telling her. And I betrayed her by letting her get caught and get caught in the middle of my fight with the jackal, not hers. And that made me really appreciate him, because I was like, yeah, because Victra is a victim in this sense, because she was lied to on both fronts and she's still choosing you. She could easily just turn her back on you. She's a gold, but she chose the harder thing. And it just really showcased his growth in that moment of like the split second decision, where I could save myself and I could get out of here easy, but I can choose the hard thing and actually fight my way out to get her.
Yeah.
Okay.
He gets out of the box, obviously. You talked about Holiday rescuing him. He gets back to this abandoned mine on Mars and figures out there's this whole society of reds and other defecting colors and the Sons of Ares living. And the Sons of Ares are alive and well. His uncle Nerol's alive. If he did fall down that mine shift, it was also a fake death. His family's there. And Sevro is in charge. And so he's kind of like re-culture shocked, because he's now in like a familiar place, but it's totally unfamiliar. And all the stakes have changed and the power has changed, but he's happy.
Sevro taking his eyes was fucking crazy.
Yeah, okay. Weird was like, shit. What, bro? What?
Do you like this, my eyes? They're yours.
Has gone too far.
Sevro is the funniest thing in the book, but sometimes you're like, ew.
Ew. He says like, some nasty ass things. Actually,
Sevro is not the funniest thing in the book. The funniest thing is Pax's dad.
Yes, Pax. Yes.
Oh my gosh. I never stopped being sad about Pax.
I know.
Like,
I miss Pax.
Yeah. Thank God the fox lived, okay?
I know.
That's the one death that would have actually hurt me. It's always the animal.
It's always the animals. Yes.
No, I was reading this book like, you better leave the telemantises alone.
The telemantises have been through enough.
They suffered their losses. I know. And like, you're taking care of Lauren's family now. Stop.
Yeah. Oh, I was so sad about Lauren, too.
Yeah.
We'll get to I'm only sad about one thing, and we'll get to that.
But okay. Yeah. I have a feeling we all know. Okay. Anyway, I did think that this was an interesting start to the book, because they're not just dealing with war. They're dealing with the nitty-gritty, like, we have all these refugees from all these different planets and societies that do not get along, and there's not enough food and there's not enough money and people are fighting, and we're trying to like save people, but instead we've just sort of like created a slum for them. And now they're like killing each other, which is real. And also, like, I think I am generally not a space odyssey person. It's just not the genre I gravitate to. But I think the really interesting point that keeps coming up in this book is how much harder it is to have a revolution that is like interplanetary because you can't easily get to everyone. Like, everyone is spread out across galaxies. It takes weeks to get to them. And so, not galaxies, but planets, whatever. And so it's so hard to control everything and stop everything and also to mount a resistance, because
not everybody feels the same way on different planets.
Everyone is so spread out. Yeah. And everyone's being treated differently. Their experience with golds is different. The rulers of their planets have different philosophies. And so it's really hard to get everyone united.
Well, and the golds have perfected a system to keep everyone else down, because it just reminds me, because if you think of like apartheid South Africa, that was the culmination of all the worst slaveries in the world coming together to make a perfect racist system. And that's what the golds did on an interplanetary level, almost intergalactic. So you're having to dissect an entire system in order to revolutionize every single color against the gold. But every single color has different experience against the gold. And they've all thought that the enemy was each other, not the golds. And I thought it was very interesting how we brought in the Obsidian story into that, and how we like dissected their experience with the golds being their gods and having to dismantle the god structure. But yeah, I thought it was so interesting, like the hunger and the violence that was within the revolution, because you can't feed everyone when you're being attacked on all sides.
When I was like, finally, someone brought up this point, and I think it was Quicksilver who brought it up. And it was that if we're so advanced and so great, why did we stop at one solar system?
Yeah.
Yep.
And it's because the more space there is, the more free people are. This was gold's way of keeping control. I was like, finally, the question I've been asking, why didn't they ever just go to more planets?
Right. Well, and like Quicksilver
brings system perfected.
Yeah. And Quicksilver brings up that capitalist motto where he's just like, I just believe in free thought and free technology. Not to say that capitalism is perfect, but when you have this very like oligarchic society where all flows to the top, the top is going to stem any sort of innovation that is not from them. And it's very interesting.
Gone backwards in innovation.
Yes.
They don't have anything automated.
Yes.
Because they fear, I actually think it's really fun and cool that he made them fear robots so much, because that's correct.
Correct.
There's no AI running their ships.
I was like, oh, fuck.
Like, they're actually powerful enough and strong enough and smart enough to know that they should draw the line and not introduce more variables that could ultimately subvert their power. But I also do think it's a great point. Like, they then had incentive to... Okay, I'm going to start over. This is also something that happens in book one when the golds parade the idea of a meritocracy out. But then we see behind the scenes, actually what's happening is the people at the top are busy reinforcing their own power. And so it's not an actual meritocracy. It's not fair. The games are rigged in favor of the jackal. The proctors are rigging the game. Powerful families are paying for their children to get into the institute. They're paying for them to have privileges and advantage in the institute. And so basically what all of that does is it stifles actual meritocracy, which from a capitalistic point of view is the ideal scenario, because you want the most qualified people to be able to contribute, because that is ultimately going to fuel companies and innovations the fastest, the quickest, the best. And so his point is, like, in stifling all these other colors, we've actually also stifled ingenuity, because we don't have these people. We're not letting them invent. We're not letting them solve problems.
Yeah. For all extensive purposes, Quicksilver should have been a governor of someplace, because he had the means.
He sort of was. A moon, though. And he was a silver. He couldn't be.
Yes.
He was like the unofficial president. He just had more money than God.
Yes, exactly. And so he should have been more powerful, but he could only go so far. And he knew he had to toe a line, because him having that much power. He
wanted to go so far.
Yes. But like the idea, his idea was like, I could do a lot more. I could have a lot more, but I knew I had to toe a line or else they would kill me, because I could not be more powerful. But he did own golds because he had so much money and had so much leverage. So it's very interesting seeing how he was one of the leaders of the Sons of Ares, because he was just like, yeah, the golds don't realize, but we need to have this meritocracy actually work for all colors in order to evolve into a new human race.
Right. Before we talk more on Quicksilver, I just want to say, can you picture, okay, how epic this would be in a movie scene where Darrow is like emaciated, standing on the edge of this cliff with Holiday and Victra, and mm-hmm. Cassius, his enemy, who he still loves, is just standing there like, don't do this, Darrow. And he jumps off a cliff and the Reds emerge from the ground and grab Boots and snatch mm-hmm. him, and his friend Severo is there. And then like that was just like the most so epic. Iconic.
Yeah. It was
That's
really
why it
cool.
needs to be on a screen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like, he could hear the sound and he knew
right.
to jump.
And we were just like, as you know, on edge as he was, because like we didn't know what was happening or where he was going either. So it was really interesting.
And the fact right. that you could see already Cassius's humanity, because he was the one that covered him when they found out that he was in the table and was like, good God, this have you no honor? Because yeah. his whole thing has been honor. And he recognizes the jackal has no honor and is a tyrant. And he's just like, I'm clocking you and we'll save that for later. Like, basically, like, I don't trust you and I don't think you should be in charge if you can do this to a person.
The other thing where they're caught off guard is the meeting with Quicksilver. They're going to kidnap him and they find out he's actually like helping lead the Sons of Ares.
That's when you learn Severo cannot be a leader.
Yeah. It's interesting for many reasons. You realize that Mustang is still alive, mm-hmm. still in play, because she's in the meeting. You realize Quicksilver is an ally and has now you have all this money behind you. Mm-hmm. And then you realize that this is where Darrow ends up having to stand up to his friends. And right. it's intense, his little fight with Severo
yeah.
over whether or not to kill / believe Quicksilver.
Right.
Darrow wins, thankfully.
Right.
That would have changed the whole thing. Game over. Yeah. Severo actually
got. If they didn't have Quicksilver, they would all be dead.
Game over.
Right. No, I did think it was really good. And I know I'm jumping ahead, but we've just brought up Cassius, so I kind of just want to talk about it now. I hated Cassius's redemption arc. I have been rooting for Darrow to kill him from book one.
I predicted it from book one.
I knew it because they could never
one thing Darrow couldn't let go of
each other. They could never let go of each other. But I was like, in my opinion, so this is part of why I think the book gets a little bit overly sentimental and a little bit too nice, actually, and generous to the characters and to human nature, because I think ultimately too many golds were willing to fight with the resistance. And I think Cassius is the one that like was just the last straw for me, because I think what should have happened is Darrow's final loss of innocence after everything should have been having to kill Cassius. Like, it's the war is going to take every last bit from you.
I would have an issue with it had Roke also got a redemption arc.
Yeah.
Only one of them could get one.
It had to be the juxtaposition of each other.
It was harder that Roke didn't get it because he was the poet. He was the lover boy. You were like, Roke, mm-hmm. you can be better than this. And then he's like, for gold. And you're like, oh, shoot. And then you realize Cassius never said for gold. Cassius said for honor.
Yeah.
Right.
And Cassius had better honor than Roke.
Right. So he just realizes where the honor lies. Yes, right. It was cheesy and chaotic for a minute there. But I saw it coming. It had to happen. The first person to take an interest in him had to be there with him at the end.
Yes.
Right.
I liked it only because it was a good foil to Roke. And it could have been the reverse, and I still would have liked it.
Yeah, if Roke had also been like, oh, man, okay. No.
No, you need one or the other.
Across the room.
Yeah. I did think it was interesting because I don't think Cassius totally trusted him until, like, Darrow gave his cards and was like, yeah, no, you know Octavia is the reason why all of your family is dead. And I will say the one thing, and I guess we'll just skip ahead to this. The one thing I didn't like was that because we're from Darrow's perspective. The fact that he was fooling the audience and lying about the capture, that's lazy. You can't do that because you're supposed to be in this guy's head. What do you mean he didn't know?
Yeah, I got real confused there for a minute and was kind of mad about it.
Yeah, like that's lazy writing, Pierce. Yeah. Shame.
It like, really let's fool everybody else. But yeah. Not me. Yeah. Not me. That was rude.
Yeah, that was one. That scene is one of the reasons why the book is only 4 stars for me, because I was like, this is why authors don't write in first person sometimes,
yeah.
Because it's hard to surprise the reader, because the reader technically knows everything the main character knows.
Yep.
It's just cheap to just not have the main character think about what's happening. Like,
you could have still had the Severo thing and like him not know that Severo had this other plan, you know?
Yeah.
Right. Like,
it but the Cassius thing
no.
made no sense when it happened.
No, I so. Knew Cassius was going to be on the side of the Red Rising. I knew it.
I did too, but I doubted it there for a minute.
Because yeah, because from Darrow's perspective. Yeah, from Darrow's perspective, he's like, I trusted wait, you, Severo's up. Dead. But then he's but then like, he, JK, was like,
and he's like, no, I don't want to take a shower. I want to stay here. I was like, all right. We're good.
Yeah, I just thought.
I also kind of.
Bothered me.
Okay, since we're talking about this scene and we're jumping all over, I kind of thought. Is he gonna do the hard thing? I thought maybe Severo would be dead.
Yeah.
I thought maybe Severo died.
But he like moved past it way too fast. So I was like,
yeah.
Same.
I don't think so.
Same. I knew something
almost
was
would have been more interesting if he lost Severo and gained Cassius.
Yeah.
That's what I think too. So another one of my little nitpicks with the book, this one is small, but I actually think more people should have died.
I agree.
I am really...
And I think the one person who died shouldn't have.
Yes. I am so upset that Ragnar died. I'm so...
Yes.
I'm like,
I stopped reading there for like a week.
Same.
I was really mad.
That's when I stopped.
I was like, stop killing the lovable giants. I want them to stay. Okay.
Justice for Pax and Ragnar.
Yeah.
That's why I was like, do not touch Kravix or Daxo.
Yeah. Oh, the Telemetuses and any other gentle giant needs to not be killed.
I honestly even think if Mustang had died, like, I feel like one of the core members should have had to go. And yeah. So I actually
I would have voted for Severo because I'm just going to say, I told you so in episode 2. I said, I think Mustang's going to end up ruling the world. And
yeah.
And she did.
That was right.
But I do
we
think
we got to have that ending. Okay.
Yeah. I do think they should have fully committed. And also, like, the reason I knew Severo wasn't dead is because the moment wasn't as epic as it needed to be for him to actually be dead. And so I was just waiting for whatever.
Trickery.
Give Cassius the full redemption arc and they're looking forward to this future, like getting to know each other again and lose Cassius. Like that would have been interesting too.
Yeah.
Right.
Like Cassius takes a bullet, essentially.
Severo just got married. Weird AF, by the way.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I actually liked the relationship. I shipped it because they were both
for sure
people.
Oh, it was so weird in the best way, but I don't know, it was cheesy,
it was so
the
rushed,
didn't need to happen for me.
All happened like all in like 100 pages and that's where
their whole relationship
that's where my 4 stars comes from, is there was so much happening right there.
Yes,
it was too much.
Yeah,
I'm not complaining about any of it, it was just all so much at once. Like you could not put down the book for the last, I don't know, quarter of it, or else you'd just be like despair.
it was a little too chaotic. It felt like it lost the reins a little bit,
but I you can't lie to your reader when you are in the head of a person. That's just not how that works.
So convenient.
If
they wanted that to happen, the other characters could have planned it and surprised Darrow. Like that would have been believable.
It would have been more believable if you just said Mustang and Severo planned it without him.
Yes.
People love to do
because
stuff without telling
him. We would have totally bought that. Yeah.
Yeah. Because he couldn't know for some reason.
No, but at this point he's taken, like he's crawled his way back into power for the correct reasons. And so like, you can't take that control from him. So instead you just took it from the reader.
Yeah. I'm like, that's whiplash. That can't happen.
Cheap. Also, okay, this is the point where also I thought the book lost a little bit of its tension and it felt like there was a little too much plot armor going on. Because what made some of the other books so good is that there were these twists and turns and things happened that Darrow and none of their allies like legitimately did not expect. Like they got done like at different points. Like they did and they got done. And that's how war is. So it made I think that is the key of what makes the other books feel so real and so intense, is because the characters are legitimately having to claw themselves back out of the most surprising, devastating, like, twists of fate and, like, maneuvers that they did not expect. In this book, and this, like, the scene that dug it in the hardest, that annoyed me the most, was this scene with Octavia, is that, oh, you just perfectly anticipated 100% of these moves? Yeah. Like,
no, here's how he wrote around that.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't anticipate it 100% because Cassius had to cut off Darrow's hand. That's the only thing they didn't anticipate.
And they didn't anticipate the jackal as much.
It's so lame. They were ready.
Surprised a little, I think. Surprised them a little.
Yeah.
But they were so ready. They knew that the jackal's fleets were going to be there and that they were going to be outmanned.
That they would be taken directly into the secret sanctum.
Right. I was like, this is so convenient that all of this worked out.
And the fact that the reader didn't know, but Darrow knew everything. I'm like, I'm still mad about it.
Was actually a smart ruler, which you think she is up until this point. She would have just killed them all.
She was cuckolded by the jackal, which feels a little too unbelievable to me.
See, that I actually liked. I liked that there was this, like,
war. No, the jackal's the best villain. Yeah.
The jackal's the best villain, but I felt like Octavia was a little too stupid at the end.
Also, he's also, like, 23. Like, come on, lady.
Yeah.
To me, the most unbelievable part of it was actually that Octavia wasn't just willing to sacrifice Luna.
Yeah.
Like, this woman blew up a moon. I know Luna's her home, but you're telling me she's just going to be willingly held hostage by this 23-year-old? Like, no, she'd just fucking murder him. Like,
well, and he's in this little sanctum. Oh, I guess he had the failsafe of what's her butt in the sky, but.
Yeah, Thistle, or whatever her name is, whatever.
Pebble.
No, Lilith.
No.
Lilith.
There we go.
All the defectors.
Yeah.
Pebble didn't defect.
I think all of that
working out. I wish they would just call people by their names sometimes.
Yeah.
I know. All of that working out just a little too perfectly, I think, is what made the book just, like, feel a little too good to be true. Like,
Okay. Before we talk about the actual too good to be true part, let's go back. We mentioned dear, sweet, beloved Ragnar. Ragnar makes it home.
Yeah.
Just not all the way. But he gets to see his sister. He wants to die, not in the traditional way with a sword in his hand, but with his friends around him. I'm upset. I was not okay.
Rip my heart out.
I still didn't cry, but I was
like, I didn't cry either.
I was pissed.
I was reading off my Kindle with my phone, like, half an inch from my face with my jaw on the floor, just like,
I can't believe you've done this.
He's like, no.
Because he survived all of this and was about to lead the revolution.
But
I understand it would have been too easy with him in charge. Seffi was a lot harder to work with.
Right.
I hate that I predicted it, though, at the beginning, because Ragnar was talking about a future. And I was like, whenever you start talking about the future, you die. So I knew he was going to die. I was mad that it happened, though.
Denial. I thought, well, you already killed his big bad protector in Pax. You can't kill the next one, too. Well, I guess you can.
Yeah.
And I think Seffi added a huge new layer to it. I thought that was interesting.
It was interesting because he showed her the truth.
Mm-hmm.
It was bloody how he did it, but they showed her the truth. And she, you know, believed. And instead of uniting the people under him, she took that truth and said, all right, well, I'm just going to unite under us, under myself, since golds aren't gods. Like, I'm in charge. You know, and earn my respect. And I was like, oh.
Right. I did love that she was so independent and wasn't easily led. Like, she was like, just because you've shown me the truth doesn't mean I have to do everything you say. Like, I'm still a queen. I am the person who's responsible for these people. I'm the leader of these people. Like, I'll come with you as long as it's beneficial to us, but we're not going to be like your little lackeys who are in love with you.
Well, yeah. When they saw the real space war is when they were like, oh, yeah, golds aren't our god, and we also just don't have to follow them because self-preservation.
Yeah.
Right.
I thought it was also interesting how she led a coup against them and tried to hang Cassius. That
was actually probably the only point where I was kind of nervous.
Yeah, I was nervous too.
And when Severo jumped, I was like,
I'm shocked.
On the floor. What?
I did know that something like that was going to happen because it was a callback to book one.
Yeah.
When Darrow took the whips, I was like, so someone has to sacrifice himself in some way. But yeah, I did like how there was commentary also on how all these people in leadership is what was unifying all the different groups. And so one of these members of leadership was so dangerous to the movement, not just because of losing their skills, but also because it destabilized a group of people that was really following them and really believed that they were looking out for, you know, whatever group.
Well, and it was another point when this, if the Obsidians are functioning on their own, you've also got these little sects of Reds functioning on their own that they mentioned throughout. Mm-hmm. And then the break off from Ares as well. And so you can't have a good rebellion if everybody has different goals and different means of achieving it. There's no united front. Right. So it's important to keep everyone in line, but also like not to do it by just overpowering them, or else you're just the same as the people you're fighting.
Because if you're fighting left to right, then you're not fighting top to bottom.
Right. And I thought this book really, really well like depicted that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I do want to say aside, just on the point of Ragnar's death, which still devastates me to this moment, I'll probably think about that character death forever.
Yeah. It's probably like top five.
Yep.
Yes. I loved Obsidian culture and the Obsidian universe.
Yes.
So fascinating, and like all the kind of inheritance from North mythology and their tribalism, and even like the design of the golds, like knowing that isolating them and forcing them into survival mode would keep them in this mm-hmm. very niche.
Well, like matriarchal area. Too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, it was so interesting. I loved the lore. I loved their kind of like magical spiritualism. Like it was mm-hmm. so fascinating.
Keeping them in the Antarctic.
People who were being their gods, you're like, oh my gosh, you're like the worst of the golds, and you're the ones keeping like these people.
The scariest of the
are
mankind.
Being kept in line by the weakest of the golds.
Yeah.
Right. Because, and it just makes so much sense how they were able to do it too, though, because if these people are isolated and they don't have any technology, and the reason they don't have any technology or advancement is because they're kept in survival mode in this barren
and they put,
wasteland.
Like, freaking sea monsters around them.
Right.
Literal like sea monsters.
If an average ass person is like, yeah, they're literally fighting monsters. Like their whole society is designed to fight monsters because that's their reality. If the average person in 2025 showed up in like 1400 with all of our modern technology, like we would also seem like gods.
We'd be gods.
We have all this stuff that we can do that would just seem like magic. And so I thought it was really smart world building and also very interesting.
It was totally different than the ways everyone else was oppressed.
Yeah.
Well, I think Reds were oppressed because they just didn't know anything. Mm-hmm. And Obsidians were oppressed because they believed they had gods. And then you get the other colors in between that are just oppressed because they're not gold. They're like living in the society and know what's going on. Right. They just can't do anything about it. So like you have all these different systems of oppression.
Yeah, because you have to oppress the Reds because they're the numbers. They're a lot more populous than everyone else. You have to oppress the Obsidians and keep them in the dark because they're the strongest of them. So it's all very like calculated and interesting.
Like, it even touches on like the Blues. The Blues want to partake so that they can do their techie things. Like it's incentive mm-hmm. for them, mm-hmm. not even oppression. Until you get the one badass lady who, Orion.
Oh my God, Orion. I love her so much. She's like, I want a parrot. I'm like, you get a parrot.
That scene, I was like, I need this.
Yeah.
Once again, on the screen.
Yeah.
But that kind of leads us to the bridge of the ship where one of the biggest deaths happens. The intergalactic battle in that. It's not intergalactic. The battle in the outer ring.
Jupiter.
We're in the gas giants, the moon lords. Roke is cornered. And Antonia hands the win to Darrow and Mustang and Victra. And we come face to face with the poet.
Yeah.
What do you think of his death? I feel like it was poetic for the poet.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if I was satisfied still.
I mean, he quotes tragedies all the time, so he's like, trying to live out his own. Revenge. Yeah.
I think it was a little bit anticlimactic. I loved that it was ultimately a pink who let them into the chamber.
Mm-hmm. A pink that he was using.
Well, and it was definitely like an Et tu, Brutus moment.
Yeah.
Even you.
Yep. And she was like, yeah, like you can't expect people to want to be your slave.
Yeah, like I'm your sex slave. I'm not going to trust you.
I'm not your lover.
Yeah. Right. This is, I'm not here with my consent. Like, yeah.
But it did. It called back to the even you, Brutus, and it was chef's kiss.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think the crescendo of it all could have been a little bit more intense. I also thought Roke's ultimate decision to kill himself could have been written a little bit more climactic. Because Darrow just sort of like gives him his space to do it.
Right. I wanted either Darrow to have to do it, which was going to be hard for him, or for him to like be actively trying to stop it or something.
Yeah.
But instead, Roke just like quotes some poetry and then says, for gold, and kills himself and hands over the biggest armada in the solar system to the enemy.
You're right.
It was kind of cowardly.
It was.
Yes.
On both fronts, Antonia and himself. It was a coward's move.
Okay, well, we all knew Antonia was a coward.
Yes. But I mean, that's kind of the idea, is that in this book series, suicide is the cowardly move.
Yeah. Well, and it's really interesting that Darrow lost Roke the day he tried to save him.
Mm-hmm.
When he, you know, injected him so he wouldn't be at that feast. That is when Roke lost his loyalty to Darrow.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, saving people isn't always the way to go. And this time he let...
You have to let people make their own decisions.
Yeah. And also, Darrow just wasn't that great of a friend to Roke.
Like, not at all.
No.
I think it is... Right. I think it is ultimately because I do think he had that instinct that he knew that Roke would ultimately not follow him. But it also is like, well, like Roke was ultimately, I think, Darrow's most painful lesson. And I do wish that that battle between them at the very end was more of a battle, like a real, I wanted them to really fight each other.
Yeah. And there's a bunch of people just sitting around watching them.
Yeah. I almost wished like Victra or someone would have like come in, Seffi would have come in and done it.
I don't know. I mean, it is, the poet got a poetic death.
Right.
It just, you're right. It was kind of anticlimactic. And maybe it was supposed to be that way. So we felt on edge like Darrow did. But
right.
I don't know.
In the end, you just die.
Well, in the end, he was just a freaking racist. So he wasn't going to change.
And blamed all of his problems on that measly red that took the spot of gold.
Right. He couldn't get past, which this is because Darrow was a bad friend, but he couldn't get past the fact that Darrow had lied about who he was. And so if you already are doubting the friendship and then you find out, you've been deceived.
Right.
But
and
I
also,
did.
The love of your life dies and you blame that person.
Okay. We all knew her for like, what, 10 days?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was not attached to her, but no.
Crazy.
I do think... I think Roke's character was also valuable, and I agree with the decision that he does not get a redemption arc, because I think it also shows you that, like, people who are racist aren't necessarily just, like, backwater idiots. Like, racism and prejudice extend to, like, the top of the most, you know, quote-unquote developed, smart, sophisticated people. And ultimately, he just did not want to give up his power.
Mm-hmm.
Nope. Didn't want to disappoint Martin.
But I love that Darrow used his name to blow up the gas giant's plant so that the gas giants couldn't come in rebellion.
The dock. Yeah, that was interesting.
Ruthless.
Clever. Manipulative. But it also is like, do I ever believe what Darrow's doing? for whatever reason. Do you know?
I loved it only because I'm a whole believer in the enemy of my enemy is not my friend. And we have learned that in our current present day when it comes to wars with the United States. So the fact that Darrow recognizes that and says, yeah, I can't let this dude have power.
Well, he also, not only did he use Rogue's name to do that, but he also in that meeting with the Moon Lord was like, asked Rogue where all the nukes are. And Rogue's like, what are you talking about? And the Moon Lord believes him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you find out it actually wasn't Rogue. It was the Jackal. And you're like, ooh.
Well, everyone knew it was the Jackal.
So that's when you kind of knew Darrow wasn't going to try and save him.
No.
Yeah. I did also love that the Rim's culture was so different. And I found it really fascinating. And their leaders really fascinating. Like, he was another great character that really stood out. Of just being this really cold but fair villain, like someone who didn't fight with emotion, but would always do what was best for his people being Golds and the Rim, no matter what, with no apology. And I thought that that was just a really interesting character to watch.
Well, and interesting that Darrow had to make the choice to free none of the solar system or part of the solar system.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, in the grand scheme of things, you free as much as you can. But now these Moon Lords and all the gas giants, their people are still not free, and they handed over the Sons of Ares as a means to an end. So, like, that was a hard decision for Darrow to make.
Right. He's
very mature.
And he hated it.
Disappointing, but he had to do it.
He at least gave them advance warning. Not much, but at least some advance warning. But yes, he had to make that decision.
They won't have the choice, you know?
Yeah, because the gas giants wouldn't trust him if he hadn't done it.
But I think to an extent he knows if communication's up and those planets see what's happening in the other places, rebellion will spark on its own.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I agree. I have a feeling the rest of the books are going to have to deal with that.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we already talked about the last scene, but I want to talk about, we have an unexpected player on the board. We have Octavia's grandson, Lysander, who's also related to Lorne.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kind of like the one, he's horrified. He's holding his grandmother together. But in the end, maybe the wisest person in the room is the child, because he hands the scepter to Mustang and says, all right, the Ash Lord, she's in charge.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What did you think about that?
That was a great twist. One of the only things in the book that felt genuinely so unexpected to me. But it made so much sense, because he was like, at this point, we're just cannibalizing ourselves. And he knew that the nexus of power that was keeping everyone together was gone. And there's, you know, you can't just, or you shouldn't just let these psychopaths blow up your planet. Like, you might as well get what you can from this and move on to fight another day.
Yeah.
And Mustang's still a Gold. She's a Gold with a bigger vision. But, if you're looking around the room and you're trying to get something done, are you going to hand it to her or the Jackal or to Severo? Yeah.
He could have chosen himself.
He was wise enough as a child to know that he would not survive that.
No.
Yeah.
He hasn't been trained enough. But I mean, he was always smart. Even in Golden Sun, he was incredibly smart. Yeah. And I think even though he saw Mustang's crew kill his grandmother, he recognized that the only way to save himself and to save the vacuum of power from collapsing the entire society was to give it to the smartest and most benevolent person in that room. And that was Mustang.
Who he knew already. She spent time with him already.
Yes.
Right. Interesting, the only essentially loose end at the book is that Lysander leaves with Cassius.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know where they go. So, theoretically, he could come back later and say, this is my birthright.
He could.
They should have killed him. That's my opinion.
They're both in exile now.
Yeah.
Do we trust Cassius that much? That was my question. Yeah.
I don't know.
I do not trust Cassius that much. Also, Lysander is so smart that he will be a formidable opponent if things come that way. Yes.
So I think that was the one loose end.
Yes. And it feels like foreshadowing almost, because you know that this is not the last you're going to see of him.
No.
And I was like, if you guys want to... You don't know where this kid is going to end up on the scale of morality. I know it's unfair. I know it's brutal and murderous. You should have killed him.
Yep.
Because this is the one person in the solar system that probably has the brains and the power and the claim to resurrect gold society the way it was.
Because he is the birthright of the sovereign.
Right.
Even though the sovereign wasn't supposed to be a birthright thing.
Yeah, it still was. Their meritocracy fails on face value.
Okay, so we have that loose end, but we get an epilogue for everybody else. And Mustangs ruling the world. Everybody's safe. They're rebuilding, trying to figure out what to do with all the Reds who want to come to the surface, etc., etc. But they take a little field trip to Earth just for a weekend, a little getaway. And everyone's reunited, and Mustang brings out a little surprise that I know Casey hates.
Yeah,
I will defend it.
Oh, I'm so mad.
I'm not mad too.
I loved it, but I will defend it. I think it had merit.
Surprise baby. Surprise baby.
I like that it was named Pax.
Sunset. Yeah.
Oh, I hated that. That's cheesy.
Riding off into the sunset with, of course, Mustang had a child the whole time, of course. I just hate it so much, and I don't think it was necessary at all.
It wasn't.
I think the ending could have been her. I still hate it. I just really hate the introduction of pregnancy into books as, like, a way to, for some reason, make you feel more emotion. I'm like, I already care about these people. You don't have to give them a child. That does nothing for me.
I just, the practicality of it hits me.
I'll defend it. Victoria wouldn't have let that happen if she didn't want it to happen. She was in control. She chose to have this child because she loved Darrow, and she chose to keep it from him. So she puts the child away in someone else's care and goes about bringing the more important thing, which is like freedom and peace, and knows that Darrow would be distracted. So she's in control this whole time. If I was Darrow, I'd be pissed that she kept this from me. Like, I think it was kind of badass of her to be like, hold on, let me go have a child, stash him away real quick, and rule the universe. And then I'll tell the baby daddy.
I mean, it makes more sense, her testing of him, because...
And her disappearance briefly while he was in a box.
Yeah, I guess here's my thing. When did the pregnancy happen? Like, there's so many factors to this where I'm just like, why did you choose to have this child in the middle of a war?
I think that's what's badass. It was her choice. And it was while everything was unstable and she wasn't sure there was going to be a happy ending. So the only piece she had was of Darrow was this child. She thought Darrow was dead.
I think that's all fine. My issue with it is not her not being in control, because she was. My issue is that I just think it's like a weak plot device that is meant to like make you feel something that I just don't feel.
It is at the end, because he mourned the child never had.
It feels cheesy.
Got a child at the end.
Deep to me. Yeah. I'm just like, we did not need to do this. Like, and it bothers me anyway that we're supposed to like care more about Io's death because she was pregnant. Like, it's Darrow lost his potential family. That's very sad. I understand this is like a full circle moment. I think they easily could have just made the epilogue being like, you know, I'm pregnant, or we're going to start a family. Like, there did not, which would have been cheesy.
Yeah, I think that would have been worse.
Would have hated it.
Yeah, that would have been worse.
But I just hate it no matter what. I'm like, why are you introducing babies into this? There doesn't have to be babies here.
Except that I think, so Pax is one of the POVs in the next series. And I think it is interesting raising essentially a mixed child in a world where there are no rules.
Mm-hmm.
And the sovereign's kid now.
Correct. So I think it adds a really interesting element. Like, people don't just stop having kids because there's a war.
I do think it's an interesting element for the next book. However, I think they should have just introduced the child in the next book.
Yeah, like, that, I agree with that.
Child, and like, oh, we had a baby.
They were trying to give you a happy ending, and I don't know if he originally intended to keep this series going.
Well, now you knew, like, there were obviously hints throughout the book where she had told his mother, and his mother reacted and was like, never mind, you can't know, like, kind of thing. I just don't love pregnancy tropes. I don't love secret child tropes.
Like, oh, no, I'm pregnant. What do we do?
Yeah. I mean, like, she is pretty badass. The fact that she was pregnant and doing a rebellion, it just feels a little far-fetched to me that she could manage all of it while pregnant, giving birth.
She wasn't. For a while, they weren't doing anything.
I don't know.
She had disappeared after seeing him in the tunnel, gone off to hide with the telemenaces, and then thought he was dead. She was probably not doing anything for a hot minute.
It's just so cloying to me. Like, there didn't need to be a baby.
It is what it is.
So annoying. It basically,
I'm not saying it needed to be there. I'm saying, though, I don't think it was a crummy story arc.
I just think it feels like
it worked fine.
A cheap emotion grab. Like,
yeah.
It just adds nothing.
You know what? You kill my favorite character. I guess I'll take a happy ending.
I think, I mean,
they could have a happy ending without a kid.
Yes.
Should have named the kid Ragnar.
Happy endings exist without the nuclear family. Like, we don't need to always be doing that.
The nuclear family was not with Darrow, though. It was with the telemanuses.
Yeah. That's the found family.
Yeah.
Papa Kavix.
Yeah. Papa Kavix.
I did really not like the ending. But it wasn't just the baby. It was that it just felt too walk off into the sunset.
It did.
Yes.
Like, stay too true easy. To the series. Guts and glory and pain. Bittersweet, okay? Not any of this now Darrow's gonna be a dad.
I feel like the gold should have rioted more under Mustang's rule.
Well, I think that's coming.
Yeah.
Because it's really hard to just start over an empire.
Especially when you've had a mixed race baby.
Yeah.
And half the solar system still not in on the game.
Yeah.
And you're trying to unravel 1,000 years of prejudice and societal structure.
Yeah.
Anyway, we've already been talking about this for way over an hour. So, do you have book recommendations?
Oh, Lord. I don't know how anything compares to this book.
The only thing that even comes close to me is probably my favorite series of all time, which is the Fifth Season series. It is heart-wrenching, heartbreaking, insanely intense, just like masterclass in world building and story structure and character arcs. Like, I like it as a series better than Red Rising. I think Red Rising book one is my favorite fantasy book of all time, but as a full fantasy series, I still give that to the Fifth Season series. So that's really the only thing that I think I've ever read that fully scratches the itch you get from this book.
Here's a question. Do you call those fantasy or do you call them sci-fi?
I still call them fantasy. I do think many of the best fantasy books are almost sci-fi, which I think is true of this series too. So
science fantasy.
Science fantasy, exactly.
I think that is actually now a genre.
Well, on that note, I will give you, I am really, really excited to pick up The Strength of the Few. So I will recommend The Will of the Many, which is the most similar in structure to this. Sort of the, like, hidden truth, the Roman world, the strange, you know, magic/science system. So I'll go back. I'm sure I recommended it for one of the other books, but The Will of the Many.
I'm just going to agree with you on that one. The only close book is The Will of the Many. And I'm very excited to pick up The Strength of the Few. It's just going to take me a while because that's a thick-ass book.
I'm looking at Red Rising, Fifth Season, Project Hail Mary, Will of the Many.
Yep, sounds about right.
Golden Sun, Fifth Season, Will of the Many, Dungeon Crawler Carl.
We're staying very true to those book recommendations.
Yeah, slay.
All right. Well, I think that's finally the end of the episode on this insane trilogy.
And the end of an era.
End of an era. It does feel that way.
It's been a while since we've done more than one book in a series.
Mm-hmm.
So, let us know what you guys think. If you've been following along and have read the full series too, we'd love to hear from you. And send us your book reviews. Send us books you want us to read. We love hearing from you guys. Also, rate and review the podcast 5 stars.
Yeah, keep sending us books you know Casey will hate so we can have more fights.
No. I like having discussions like this.
Yeah, please.
Send us books we'll all like.
Yeah. It's the best when the book is just really interesting.
Yes. Like,
tickle our brains, guys.
Right.
Make us think.
I feel like a listener recommended Red Rising, and that's where we started on this.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember. I think someone did.
Also, I saw it all over TikTok. And
that's true as well.
Everyone to read it.
Yeah.
But okay. I would love a new Red Rising series.
The left field, like, fantasy sci-fi ones usually come from me.
That's true. You're the science fiction girly.
Science fantasy.
Science fantasy. You're welcome. Anyway, with that, I'm Catherine.
I'm Caitlin.
And I'm Casey. Thanks for listening. And when you get a chance, take a break with the Busy Girls Book Club.